Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. For the seventh and final time of his presidency, President Barack Obama will stand before Congress and the American public to lay out his vision for not only his remaining months in office, but for the future of the United States. The president said in an Oval Office video previewing his address that he's never been more optimistic about the path that the United States is on. It's that optimism, the White House officials say, will be showcased when the president addresses the nation for his last State of the Union Tuesday. VOA will carry live coverage of the president's speech beginning Wednesday at 2 hours universal time. Algerian security forces arrested seven Islamist gunmen on Tuesday in the remote southern area of In Aminas, which is close to the gas plant where a deadly attack took place in January 2013, according to the country's defense ministry. The statement did not link the militants with any group, but Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb and small pockets of the Islamic State-affiliated fighters operate in some parts of Algeria, according to an OPEC producer of oil and gas. Weapons and three vehicles were seized during the ambush of the gunmen. A new study says more than half of the children in war-ravaged South Sudan are currently not in school. That's the highest proportion of any country in the world. The United Nations Children's Fund said Tuesday that 51% of kids between the ages of 6 and 15 in South Sudan are not being educated. Oil dived Tuesday close to $30 on abundant crude supplies as OPEC member Nigeria called for an emergency meeting to address collapsing prices that have ravaged revenues. In late afternoon deals, New York's benchmark West Texas Intermediate for February delivery tanked to $30.10 a barrel, the lowest level since December 2003. This is VOA News. German police arrested more than 200 far-right extremists who went on a rampage in the eastern city of Leipzig, setting cars on fire and damaging property. The chaos began late on Monday. At about the same time, thousands of supporters of the anti-migrant Pegida movement demonstrated carrying signs with slogans such as Freedom for Germany. Counter-demonstrators carried a banner saying Welcome in Leipzig and saying No Pegida. A police spokesman said many of the suspected offenders are known to police. A top Afghan official says he is confident a renewed push to resurrect stalled peace talks with Taliban groups, for ending the conflict in Afghanistan will yield positive results. Ayaz Ghul reports.
Senior Afghan, U.S., Pakistani and Chinese diplomats met Monday in Islamabad to coordinate efforts to try to pave the way for a new round in the Afghan reconciliation process. Deputy Foreign Minister Hikmat Khalil Karzai, who led the Afghan delegation in the talks, briefed reporters Tuesday about the meeting and promised further progress when the four-nation group meets again next week in Kabul.
This roadmap in this discussion was shared with our Pakistani, Chinese and American colleagues.
Afghans and U.S. officials believe the Taliban leadership is sheltering in Pakistan amid allegations Pakistan's military uses the group as its proxy force in Afghanistan. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
At least eight Germans were killed and nine seriously injured in a suicide bombing attack in Istanbul. That's according to the German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier on Tuesday, citing information he had received from Turkey. It's been years since we were hit by terror as hard as we've been hit now in Istanbul, according to Steinmeier. Myanmar pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is calling for all factions to be included in the newest round of peace talks between armed ethnic groups and the country's outgoing quasi-civilian government. The Nobel Peace Laureate made her comments on the opening day of the negotiations in the capital. British oil and gas company BP announced plans on Tuesday to slash 5% of its global workforce in the face of a continued slump in oil prices. It says it aims to reduce its global oil production headcount by 4,000 to 20,000 as it undergoes a $3.5 billion restructuring program. With crude oil prices at 12-year lows at around $32 a barrel, the world's biggest oil and gas producers are set to continue aggressively slashing spending this year as they face their longest period of investment cuts in decades. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wu-Heben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Cameroon has arrested hundreds of people who allegedly attacked police stations in the capital Yaoundé to protest human rights abuses, brutality and extortion. Huge consignments of locally made guns and explosives have been seized as the arrests continue.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details next.
Also, according to a new report, 24 million children around the world are unable to attend school because of conflict. And Niger's army chief says his country is in the process of winning the war against Boko Haram.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Cameroon has arrested hundreds of people who allegedly attacked police stations in the capital, Yaoundé, to protest human rights abuses, brutality, and extortion. Huge consignments of locally made guns and explosives have been seized as the arrests continue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
François Martin Claude, the most senior police official in Cameroon's central region, where Yaoundé is located, says the approximately 500 youths already in police custody were arrested following tips from some inhabitants of the capital city and information from their intelligence services.
Les populations nous ont aidés à mettre main sur ces voyous. Nous allons mettre la main sur.
He says police have been benefiting from the assistance of the population that has been denouncing suspects. He says it is intolerable to allow such a thing in a capital city like Yaoundé, and they will arrest all the youths who want to terrorize inhabitants of Yaoundé. Most of the youths were arrested in night raids on their homes and street corners in their neighborhoods. The police say at least 100 of those detained have no identification documents. 40-year-old Teda Biloa Aristide, whose younger brother was arrested, says more than 30 soldiers stormed and ransacked their Mokolo residence on the night of January 9 without authorization.
La manière dont le gouvernement camerounais a pu procéder, pour moi, c'est une démarche arbitraire.
He says the arrests have been arbitrary and violate human rights. He says proper investigations should have been carried out to determine who the leaders of the group are before any arrests. University of Yaoundé law student Penda Josue says arresting the suspects will not solve what he calls an endemic problem in a country that has been suffering from Boko Haram terrorist threats. He says investigations should be carried out to see if the terrorist group Boko Haram is extending its activities from Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria to the capital, Yaoundé.
Je veux savoir si la police fait exactement son travail. Ces habitants du Cameroun, Yaoundé, capital.
He says the fact that some inhabitants of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, now keep guns in their houses means the police department is a corrupt accomplice and is not doing its job. He says the government should investigate the origin of the weapons. The arrests follow last Thursday's attacks by hundreds of disgruntled and armed Cameroonian young people on police stations in Mokolo, a popular market in Yaoundé. The youth said they were against police brutality, extortion, and other human rights abuses. But the police said they were looking for revenge after the death of a popular suspect who died in a shootout with the police. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A new report says there are nearly 24 million children around the world unable to attend school because of conflict. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, says that puts their future and their country's future at risk. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
UNICEF studied 22 countries affected by conflict. Education and emergency specialist Lisa Bender gives an overview of what was found.
I think the headline message is that we're seeing more and more children affected by conflict, and the impact of that conflict lasting longer. Children are out of school longer. More children are out of school. They're facing more difficulties when they're in school because of conflict. And we're really worried about this trend.
The findings show that nearly one in four of the more than 109 million kids of primary and lower secondary school age who live in conflict zones are missing out on their education.
We're primarily talking about the key ages between 6 and 15. So this doesn't even count children who are missing early learning opportunities. We're really talking about primary school through lower secondary school, the key years for learning.
Bender says at the top of the UNICEF list of countries where conflict is disrupting education is Africa's newest nation.
The country with the highest proportion of out-of-school children is South Sudan. Over half of their children are out of school. Niger is a close second with 47% of their children unable to attend school, followed by Sudan at 41%. And though Afghanistan has made significant progress, they still have 40% of their children out of school.
As for Syria, the country driving Europe's migrant and refugee crisis, Bender says it once had most of its kids in school.
We've seen many children in Syria who are now not able to attend school because of the conflict, but there's been such a huge population movement, as you know, into the surrounding countries and now with the European migrant crisis, that it's hard to say exactly how many of those children are accessing learning opportunities, if they're formal or non-formal. We're doing our best to provide services with many partners for those children, but it's very hard to get a specific number.
UNICEF's analysis says a lack of education puts children's future at risk.
We mean that they won't have the skills that they need to access the job market. They won't have the basic skills that they need to negotiate life. In the countries where we have seen children access education in small villages in Afghanistan, for example, where I visited, these children play a crucial role in negotiating contracts for their parents, being able to understand how to get good prices at the local market. So we're talking about daily living skills as well as the long-term skills they need to become the future teachers and doctors and leaders of their countries.
If a generation of children grows up without these skills, Bender says countries suffer in the long term. For example, economies and health could decline, while girls become more vulnerable to sex abuse. Conflicts have also taken a toll on school buildings.
We see many schools that are destroyed or unsafe to use. There are unexploded ordinances. There are soldiers or armed groups who are occupying schools or creating a chilling effect by engaging in activity near schools. So even those children who are in school are facing significant increased risk to their safety and well-being.
UNICEF and its partners are calling on donors and governments to make education a major part of humanitarian efforts in conflict zones.
We need to shift our attitude from saying we'll get back to school when things calm down to saying that we can't afford to let education stop.
To do that, UNICEF reports it's working to create safe environments where children can learn and play to restore normalcy to their lives. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, reports that approximately 19,000 migrants have made the treacherous journey across the Mediterranean Sea during the first 11 days of 2016. The period also saw the year's first fatalities on the central Mediterranean route between Libya and Italy. Smugglers forced men and women into the sea to swim to shore. Women who refused to jump in the water were beaten. Flavio Di Giacomo is the IOM spokesperson for Italy. He says Italian authorities recovered the body of a drowned woman reportedly thrown into the sea by smugglers. 37 other Somali migrants who were thrown overboard made it to shore safely from the same vessel. Di Giacomo spoke with me about the plight of migrants and refugees risking their lives to reach European shores.
Actually, we have seen the arrival since January 1st. More than 18,000 people in these first 11 days of the month. Well, the majority of migrants arrived in Greece, 18,600, while in Italy we didn't register any arrival until yesterday because of the conditions of the sea, which were very rough. But yesterday, 220 people were rescued at Cinecittà, Sicily, and brought to Lampedusa, while other 37 people arrived off the coast of Apulia, and unfortunately they were dead and missing migrants, because in that case, both carrying about 42 migrants, all Somalis, men and women, coming from Greece, well, they arrived close to the coast of Apulia, and once there, the smugglers, they actually forced them to jump into the water and swim, even those who didn't have any life jackets. And those who resisted and didn't want to jump, especially women, were beaten. So they were forced to jump in the water. And unfortunately, many of those migrants, they were not able to swim. While about 37 people made it, others went missing, and the corpse of a dead woman was found. We fear that all the missing and dead are women who couldn't swim.
Why did the smugglers force them to jump into the water?
Probably because they didn't want to reach the shore, so they just wanted to let the migrants go and come back without being arrested by the authorities.
This number of migrants so far reaching the shores of Europe, has it exceeded the number this time last year?
Reportedly, we still have to check out all the statistics, but yes, because the main difference compared to last year is the fact that last year the arrivals in Greece, they started after a few months of 2015. So the first month of the year, we haven't registered many arrivals. We know that the big crisis involving Greece started actually from the spring with the arrival of about 4,000 migrants per day in the Greek islands. So at the time of the year, I remember that there were arrivals in Italy, just in Italy, many arrivals, but not 18,000. Even if I remember very well that last year in the Channel of Sicily, we've seen already in February many, many deaths. I remember that there were about 400 deaths in the first days of February in the Channel of Sicily. So the situation is not getting any better. We know that the journeys in this period of the year are very dangerous because of the sea conditions. So even if the journey from Turkey to Greece lasts only about 1 hour, the sea conditions now are very rough, so the migrants are risking their lives. So we are quite worried about that in this period.
Do you all have any new action plans that you are putting in place to help protect the migrants?
Well, in that case, we know that both in Greece and in Italy, the authorities are doing their best to rescue migrants at sea, the Coast Guards, the Navy, the European Union operations like Triton. IUM is both in Greece and Italy to provide assistance to those who arrive at land. And the problem is that all the migrants arriving in Italy and Greece, they arrive from a situation of crisis. We know the situation in Libya now is quite complicated. We really don't know what will happen in the country, and this will affect, of course, the arrival of migrants. So we will discover it in the next few weeks, probably. While in Greece, we know that there are many, not only Syrians, but also Afghans, arriving by sea. And as long as the Syrian crisis will not get any better, we expect other migrants to arrive in the next few months.
That was International Organization for Migration spokesperson Flavio Di Giacomo. He spoke with me from Italy.
And in Leipzig, Germany, last night, about 2,000 people protested Chancellor Angela Merkel's open-door refugee policy. Police say during the protest, about 200 mass protesters rampaged through the streets of the city's southern district, breaking store windows, putting up barricades and setting off fireworks. In response, thousands of others took to the streets of Leipzig to plead for tolerance. Street demonstrations have occurred in other German cities since reports that hundreds of young men attacked women during New Year's Eve celebrations in front of Cologne's main rail station. Authorities are investigating charges against more than a dozen men. Some eyewitnesses claim the assailants were Middle Eastern or North African. Meanwhile, deportation of migrants continues in several European Union countries. Italy has organized flights to return 153 would-be migrants to Egypt and to Tunisia. Additional flights have returned other migrants to Nigeria. Greece, meanwhile, has deported dozens of migrants to Pakistan, Albania, Kosovo, Armenia, and Georgia.
New figures show it was a deadly holiday season on South African roads. The transport ministry says during the six-week season, 1,800 people were killed in 1,400 crashes. That's a 14% increase from the previous year. A World Health Organization report says about 1.25 million people are killed in traffic accidents globally each year. Africa has the highest traffic fatality rate. In other news, the U.S. has given South Africa until March 15th to allow U.S. poultry products into the country. Failure to do so means South Africa could lose duty-free access for its farming exports to the U.S. under AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. South Africa exported $176 million in agricultural products to the United States under AGOA in 2014. Potential lost benefits are estimated to be between $4 and $7 million. Last week, the two countries did complete talks on various meat imports.
Some economists are warning that Zimbabwe's finances are in a catastrophic state and that this year will see further dramatic declines in state revenue and economic growth. Delia Robertson reports from Johannesburg on the current situation and prospects for the future.
In December, soldiers and security personnel received salaries and bonuses on time. Other Zimbabwean civil servants were paid late. Two journalists who reported this information were charged with publishing false information and will appear in court later this month. These developments illustrate the assessment of Japanese research fellow Ken Yamamoto. The Zimbabwean economy is crashing so rapidly that the government will collect far below the $3.6 billion revenue it predicted in its financial plan. Writing for an online Zimbabwean news site, Mr. Yamamoto said this will repeat what has happened each year since the 2013 election, with the deficit growing in each succeeding year. Since it came to power in 1984, the Zimbabwe government has not built any power plants and existing infrastructure is in a perilous state due to neglect. By December, Zimbabwe's inability to produce sufficient power had deteriorated to the point that the country was without power for 18 hours each day. South Africa, struggling with its own power infrastructure, came to the rescue with 300 megawatts per day, easing the crisis. Diana Games, CEO of Africa at Work, says neglect of the power infrastructure has contributed to the deindustrialization of the country.
The reason that Zimbabwe is deindustrialized is because there's a lack of power, of a lack of political certainty, lack of working capital, and so on.
Traditionally, the mainstay of Zimbabwe's economy was agriculture. It exported food and tobacco both regionally and globally. This suffered a severe blow when the government launched its chaotic and often violent land reform program in 2000, which saw most commercial farmers forced off their land. In recent years, production by the small-scale farmers who acquired land as a consequence of land reform has grown. In normal rainfall years, they produce enough for local consumption and have also started exporting tobacco. However, production remains well below that before 2000. Ms. Games says this will not improve as much as needed without access to a regular supply of power. This, she says, remains in the distant future.
These things have a long turnaround time. And Zimbabwe really needs, it can't build the economy despite all the other challenges. If they don't have power, that puts Zimbabwe in a very difficult place for agriculture, mining and all the other sectors where it does generate some revenue at the moment.
And like Ms. Yamamoto, Ms. Games notes that Zimbabwe needs foreign direct investment to initiate and sustain a regeneration in the economy. Both note that at present, Zimbabwe lacks the political leadership key to this, but Ms. Games says that in addition, a nationalistic ethos in Zimbabwean companies is a deterrent to FDI.
One of the big problems is that a lot of Zimbabwean companies don't really want people to invest in them or to take stakes in them. They simply want working capital to revive their businesses.
Observers like Ms. Games and Mr. Yamamoto believe that for Zimbabwe to get the economic regeneration it needs will require a fundamental change in the style of political leadership. They and others say this will have to come from within the ruling ZANU-PF itself, as the chances for an opposition party coming to power in the foreseeable future are remote. Ms. Games says Zimbabwean leaders need to demonstrate a commitment to economic regeneration rather than political expedience and political power to start the process.
And certainly that strong leadership, predictable in a good way, would also unlock all sorts of other funding for Zimbabwe, ability to reschedule debt and issues like that.
Ms. Games says until that happens, Zimbabwe will remain a high-risk investment destination plagued by ongoing economic decline. Delia Robertson for VOA, Johannesburg.
Niger's army chief says his country is in the process of winning the war against Boko Haram. The northern Nigerian militant group has launched numerous attacks against Niger as well as Chad and Cameroon. General Seni Garba says he is confident even though the terrorist group still has what he calls the capacity to harm. Estimates say Boko Haram has killed about 17,000 people over the past 6 years and caused the displacement of more than 2.5 million people. Meanwhile, a Nigerian Air Force official says the military has degraded Boko Haram's ability to launch large-scale attacks. He says the group has had to resort to suicide bomb attacks.
In Turkey, foreign tourists are said to be among those killed and injured in a suicide attack in Istanbul's main tourism district. Turkish officials say at least 10 people were killed and 15 others injured. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Police and ambulances were quickly on the scene of the blast. The powerful explosion heard across much of the city struck late morning in Istanbul's Sultan Ahmet district, the main tourism quarter of the city. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan condemned the attack.
Türkiye'nin terörle mücadele konusundaki kararlı ve ilkeli...
Turkey is a top target for all terrorist groups in the region, he added. Turkey is fighting against all of them equally. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said the attack is believed to have been carried out by Islamic State. No details of the attack were given at a news conference following an emergency meeting of senior ministers and intelligence chiefs. The bomber was identified as a 28-year-old, described as of Syrian origin. Most of those killed and injured were foreign nationals. Although the group never claimed responsibility, IS militants were blamed last year for 2 suicide attacks that killed more than 130 people, including one in the capital, Ankara. The government has been criticised by opposition and its allies for failing to crack down hard enough on the jihadist group, instead focusing attention on its battle against the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, a charge it strenuously denies. Observers say Kurdish rebels could also be a suspect. Turkish security forces are carrying out a major crackdown across towns and cities in the predominantly Kurdish southeast. A splinter Kurdish group called TAK claimed responsibility for a mortar attack last month on Istanbul's second largest airport. Dorian Jones, VOA, Istanbul.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa, this is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon arrests hundreds of people who allegedly attacked police stations in the central capital of Yaoundé to protest human rights abuses. A new report says there are nearly 24 million children around the world unable to attend school because of conflict. And Niger's army chief says his country is in the process of winning the war against Boko Haram. Coming up, we have music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, in South Sudan, women want peace to be realized and their suffering to end. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for football players from Argentina and the U.S.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Lionel Messi and Carly Lloyd, who were named the Male and Female World Footballers of the Year for 2015 by FIFA, the sport's international governing body. Barcelona and Argentina superstar Messi won FIFA's Ballon d'Or trophy for the fifth time in 7 years. And American midfielder Carly Lloyd won her first ever FIFA Women's Player of the Year award at the ceremony in Zurich, Switzerland.
It's very rewarding. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of tough times, frustrating times, but if you stay the course and you never lose sight of what you want to accomplish in life, it's all possible. So tonight is just a recognition of everything that I've been through, and hats off to my teammates as well.
Carly Lloyd's teammates won the Women's World Cup trophy for a record third time last July in Vancouver, Canada. The USA beat defending champion Japan 5-2 in the final, and Lloyd sparkled in the championship match. Carly scored 3 goals, including a remarkable strike from midfield. Carly Lloyd also scored in the round of 16, the quarterfinals, and the semifinals, and she won the Golden Ball as best player at the Women's World Cup. The 33-year-old Lloyd also tied with Germany's Celia Sasic for the scoring crown with 6 goals apiece. Sasic was also a finalist for the FIFA Women's Player of the Year award. She says Lloyd was a deserving winner.
When you play, you always want to win. That's true. And but for me, it was really an honor to be under the 3 nominees with such great players. And I think Carly is really a good winner, and she deserves it because she played an amazing World Cup. So I enjoyed the whole evening.
Meanwhile, I think you can say Jill Ellis enjoyed the whole evening in Zurich, too. Ellis guided the American women to the World Cup title in Canada last year. And she was named FIFA's Women's Coach of the Year for 2015.
It's great. It's a tremendous honor, and obviously represents a lot of people, and always want to thank our players and our staff for doing such a great job. But I'm immensely proud. I never thought out when I started this career that I'd end up here, so it's a dream. Coach is a roller coaster. You just got to put your seatbelt on and enjoy the ride. And so there's ups and downs, but this is certainly a big up.
Buckle up and enjoy the ride, Coach. That's Jill Ellis, who directed the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team to its third world title last year in Canada. And Spanish manager Luis Enrique of Barcelona received the Men's Coach of the Year trophy during the festivities in Zurich.
Voice of America!
I only vote on America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Turning to African football, Nigeria edged Ivory Coast Monday 1-0 in a friendly match played in South Africa. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, has more details for us from Johannesburg.
A first-half strike by midfielder Ifeanyi Matthews handed Nigeria 1-0 victory over Ivory Coast in the South African capital, Tshwane, on Monday. Both teams are set for the African Nations Championship CHAN, starting in Kigali, Rwanda, on Saturday. Meanwhile, Ivory Coast coach Michel Dusayer says they'll face CHAN hosts Rwanda with determination on Saturday. He concedes his side had a poor first half against Nigeria.
We conceded four opportunities before the goal, and it was logical that the Nigeria lead at the halftime. In second half time, we tried to push on the end of the game to be back on the score, but we failed. You know, it's a friendly game, but it was an important game because of confidence before the first game against Rwanda. We know it will be a tough game. So,
like you said, you are playing the first match against the home side. Do you feel that your team is ready for the action?
You know that we are able to do well. We proved it because we took over Ghana during the eliminate for qualifying here, so we know we can do well. It's a tough group because of the home team and because of Morocco and Gabon, which is good sides too, so we know it's a tough group, but we will have to fight against Rwanda, against his crowd. I hope we don't have to fight against referee.
That was Michel Dusayer, the Ivory Coast coach, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Still in Tshwane, Nigeria coach Sunday Olise is pleased that his injured strikers have recovered in time for action in Rwanda. He's satisfied with the team's performance against the Ivory Coast.
But I think the boys are in top spirit and physically solid. And you know, the Ivory Coast Nigeria rivalry is always there. So, and they really give us a good fight. Because my boys didn't let them play. But what the good thing is that even though we won 1-0, we created lots of chance, scoring chance. And let's just hope that Rwanda will tap them in.
You said earlier that some of your players had taken knocks. What's the condition now? Have they recovered?
Yeah, like you saw the two strikers they played today. And the third one was the... Who was the third one again? It was Akas, the captain. Yes. And he played 90 minutes.
That was Sunday Olise, Nigeria Super Eagles coach, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Nichabulile.
Hola. Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
More African football news now on the VOA. The qualifying competition for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Gabon will resume in March. So says our African football guru, David Legg.
In March, in fact, we got back-to-back rounds. We've got match day 3, followed immediately by match day 4. In the space of 8 days, the top seeds in each group would play each other home and away. And among the very interesting ties, we're going to have Nigeria against Egypt and Cameroon against South Africa. We'll then have another round in June and the final round in September. And what that will produce, Sonny, is 13 group winners and also the best two runners-up. They will also qualify. And, of course, Gabon automatically qualify as the host nation. Now, if we look at Egypt and Nigeria, the Pharaohs have already stolen a bit of a march on the Super Eagles because the Egypt team, they've beaten Chad and they've beaten Tanzania. very impressively. So they've got 6 points. Nigeria, after a home win over Chad, were held to a draw by Tanzania in Dar es Salaam. So they've got 4 points. Now, what the Nigerians cannot, under any circumstance, afford is to lose twice to the Egyptians, because I believe that would cost them any chance of topping the group and probably also any chance of finishing among the top two best second-place teams. It's going to be fascinating. Here we have Egypt, record 7 times African champions. And then we've got the unpredictable Super Eagles. 2013, against the odds, beat Ivory Coast in the quarterfinals and went on to beat Burkina Faso in the final. Champions of Africa for the third time. And what happens 2 years later? They don't even qualify for the finals. They finish third behind South Africa and Congo Brazzaville. Real surprise that, and eventually it cost Stephen Keshi his job. The man in charge now is Sunday Oliseh. He will certainly be expected by the Nigerian public as well as the Nigerian officials to get the Super Eagles to Gabon for the finals, either as group winners or one of the best two runners-up. And to do that, he's going to have to take a minimum, I stress, minimum of 3 points. That means one victory. And that probably is the way that one could turn out, Sonny, with maybe the Egyptians favourites at home and the Nigerians also favourites to use home advantage. A team in a lot more trouble than either Nigeria or Egypt are South Africa. They've had a disastrous start to their group. They could only draw 0-0 at home with Gambia and then were beaten 3-1 away by Mauritania. So they're rock bottom in their group with just 1 point, and Cameroon are way out in front with 6 points. Now, what we have coming up in March is Cameroon against South Africa in Yaoundé and also at a South African venue. And the very tall order indeed for the South Africans is they're almost certainly going to have to win both games and at the very least win at home and draw away to have a realistic chance of making it to Gabon. South Africa have not done well of late. They did reach the 2015 finals, but before that they had a really poor run, failing to qualify on several occasions. Cameroon are the only country who have never lost at home in an African Cup of Nations qualifier. That is a very formidable record. 47 matches unbeaten, predominantly at the Stade Amadou Amahidjo in Yaoundé. So to say that it's going to be a tough task for South Africa is probably an understatement. And they are the dominant two groups as we head into March.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Nairobi, street vendors are changing the way they prepare meals after learning the basics of food safety. And next, in South Sudan, women want peace to be realized and their sufferings to end. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs from Cameroon with Africa Higher Higher.
No. put yourself upon its throne. Hey, yeah, yeah. 20 years for power. Why? 30 plus and 14 more. 30 plus and 14 more. All the worries that my family and my friends they found in me.
Deborah Debs with Africa, Higher, Higher.
In Nairobi's poorest neighborhoods, street vendors and small shops feel the need for quick, affordable meals. But any food can be a health hazard if it is not prepared properly. VOA's Steve Barragona reports a number of street vendors are changing the way they prepare meals after learning the basics of food safety.
James Kuria cooks hot meals at the 11th Hour Butchery in Nairobi's Viwandani neighborhood. He says customers come to him for three reasons.
Because I have made the good friendship with them. I have quality meat and also my place, I have tried to keep it in best good conditions.
Shops like Kuria's are essential in communities where many people don't have time or kitchens to prepare meals, says Nicholas Ngomi with the African Population and Health Research Center.
You can find them entirely depending on the food vendors to get the food. So it's very important that we take care of the food vendors if we are to take care of the health of the people living in this settlement.
Kuria says there was a lot about food and health he did not know until recently. For example, his meat goes bad in just a few days.
If it will last here for long, it may be bring some disease to my customers.
That's one lesson from a training session Ngomi helped set up. Ngomi is part of a project studying how diseases move through slum neighborhoods. Food is one major route. When the vendors Ngomi's team is studying found that out, they said help us stop it.
Teach us about how these diseases come about. Yeah, so then we took it up and we rolled out the training for them.
25 food vendors spent half a day learning the fundamentals of food safety.
We also went to the basics even of how they should clean their hands and how they should clean the foodstuffs. We also went ahead and taught them on how they should entertain and keep their customers, so how they should have as many customers as they would.
Asante.
Only a few hawkers got training. The hope is that food safety habits will spread through the neighborhood and food poisoning will not. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Nairobi.
South Sudanese women have noticed that not one woman was named as governor of the 28 new states. Women say their expectations for 2016 are simple and straightforward. They want peace to be realized, and they want their sufferings to end. VOA fellow Kala Tuma Vanisa spoke to several South Sudanese women and has this report.
Mary Jastutombe is a journalist and an activist in Juba. She says her hope for this year is to see that the government implements lasting peace so that all the suffering, including hunger, rape, and loss of loved ones, come to an end.
The government and the SPLM in opposition should have a political will to implement this peace, because the people of South Sudan, and in particular women, have suffered enough during the war, and they are still continuing to suffer. This war now has worsened the economy of the country. People are unable to put one meal on the table. Children are on the streets. Everybody is scattered. So for next year, if the government of national unity is in place, I hope that things will become better.
Pelek Obur, executive director for Women Empowerment Project in Juba, says in 2016, the guns must be silenced.
For 2016, we expect not to hear guns again. We expect the guns to stop. For 2016, we expect that the process of reconciliation and healing for the entire nation would have started.
Pelek also says the government should include women in the process of developing the country.
Take women seriously and do not treat women issues as if they are not important issues. Because if it was not for the women of South Sudan, we wouldn't have had independence, we wouldn't have had separation. And if it was not women who equally fought on the front lines with men in this struggle to have South Sudan, we wouldn't have made it.
Davidika Ikai chairs the Network Women Group in Torit. She says her expectations for this year are simply for peace to prevail.
My message to the entire South Sudanese people, especially the men, when there is any issue, it shouldn't be a gun, but let it be in form of dialogue. Let us promote dialogue rather than gun.
Lily Hidita is a businesswoman in Torit Market. She says 2016 must be the year that women can make money and support each other. She says if women get higher-ranking government positions, including governors, they can support each other.
When our women holding a position like a governor in other states, she will be able to promote their fellow women. And the government can not take all of us, but for the women of South Sudan, I'm advising them to come out next year, do business. And secondly, those who are dropped out from the school, let them go back to adult education.
South Sudanese women say without peace, there is no life, no development. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa 7 News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Cornelius Tenner. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The peaceful conduct and high turnout in the first round of presidential and parliamentary elections in the Central African Republic are clear signs that Central Africans seek a new beginning for their country and a future based on democratic governance and free from the violence and instability that have plagued the country for far too long. The United States commends all Central Africans who, with support from international forces, ensured the vote on December 30 was peaceful and secure. As the Central African Republic moves towards the second round of elections in the coming weeks, we reiterate our desire to see this spirit of peace, tolerance, and free expression. And we strongly urge all parties and their supporters to peacefully address any disputes regarding the recent announcement of results through the Central African legal system. These elections are an historic opportunity for Central Africans to build a united, prosperous, and democratic future for their country and establish a government that reflects the country's rich geographic, ethnic, and religious diversity. In that effort, they will find a steadfast supporter in the United States. The United States stands with the Central African Republic at this critical moment and will continue to be a strong friend and ally of the Central African people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama will deliver his final State of the Union address. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss his speech and his foreign policy agenda for Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.